You lost a lot of people money today.
Ah, oh, those bets.
Sorry.
Look, if I had gotten caught by any cops along the way, then potentially could have been there, but I wasn't driving too fast. I'm getting involved with a little startup which a few of you might know about, and so we'll see where that goes for the next couple of years. We'll see.
Is the name secret?
Huh?
Is the name secret?
No, the startup's called Zigra, Zigra. You can look up. There's a website, but there isn't much of my secret sauce on it yet. But yeah, it has a website, so it's totally legit. Yeah, I know. It's like exactly. But yeah, I know DNS.
Actually, I wonder who they're using in the registrar. I should probably check that sometime.
But anyway, so today what I want to talk about was kind of where I see the stuff we've talked about in class over the semester integrating into kind of the computing landscape, at least for the next few years, maybe a little further out. What's really interesting is over the past, like since my last lecture, there's been a couple of interesting developments along that space, which are things that somewhat surprised me, but otherwise didn't surprise me. So do they know the announcements I'm talking about?
I said it like 2 minutes ago.
What, huh?
I said it 2 minutes ago.
Yeah. Oh, you did? Okay.
Well,
there's actually a couple, because there's, there's Rust.
Oh yeah, that's the
first one. There's two of them. So the announcements are that Google is forking WebKit. So WebKit they have their own. Right now, WebKit is the basis of Safari and Chrome and a lot of other browsers. It's the central rendering engine. They're forking it and they're calling the new one Blink. What the heck is that name? I know the Blink tag.
Yeah.
I know, but what sort of name?
It wasn't like Blink.
Yeah.
It's ironic.
So what they're doing basically is specializing WebKit for Chrome. They're basically ripping out the part of the code that anyone else would want to use and just keeping the stuff Chrome needs. So, which will greatly simplify their version and will potentially allow them to potentially modify it faster, so actually potentially give them a competitive advantage, but it's definitely a fork. And I'm not sure it'll be interesting to see how much of their changes get put back into the mainstream WebKit. But, so this is definitely fragmentation in the browser engine space. So that's one interesting development. The other interesting development is Mozilla. Mozilla and Samsung have teamed up. So apparently Mozilla has had a next generation rendering engine that they've been developing. What is it called? Servo. Yes. So they call it Servo. And in order to build Servo, they're creating a new programming language called Rust.
That's cool.
So they are prototyping the language and developing Servo at the same time. So the language, Rust is apparently at version 0.6 or something. It's based on LLVM, so LLVM gives you this low-level compiler infrastructure, so building a nice compiler on top of that is not completely insane. What's interesting about it is that there's other languages in the space, like, for example, Go. And they specifically said, we don't like Go so much. And one of the things they said about Go... So Go is supposed to be safer than C++. And so, safer means fewer errors, fewer security vulnerabilities, stuff. And it is. But it still allows you to have null pointers. Apparently, their whole design of Rust is to eliminate the possibility of having null pointers. You can't do pointer arithmetic in Go. In Rust, you won't have nulls. Which, apparently, the way they do this is with some enhanced type system, I don't know exactly what they're doing with it, and I'm kind of curious about it, but the idea is they want C++ levels of performance, they want good concurrency in a safer language. So the goals are kind of similar to Go's, but they basically said, we don't like what Go is, we want to do things different. They've got some interesting technical reasons for it, and they're building a multi-core ready rendering engine, basically called this. So there's this, and I bet you that this is part of also what Google is thinking, is they want to make WebKit more, their architecture more amenable to splitting the thing across multiple cores, multiple processes and stuff, so they want to refactor things, and they can't do it with all the legacy cruft, so they're doing this. So. I mean, I haven't got a chance to study it, so I don't really know what their concurrency model is in Rust, but I think it's similar to Go in certain ways in the sense of it's more coroutine based. So basically, all these things are trying to divide up execution into little bundles of execution that can be scheduled independently and potentially cooperatively. Normally, they're all cooperative multitasks because the moment you get a scheduler in, you have threads, and it's much slower. If it's cooperative, you can scale up. Basically, cooperative multitasking is the cost of a function call. And since function calls, you do them all the time, it's cheap. That's the same level of overhead. So why this is interesting, even if you're not someone who implementing web browsers, just as a person on the web, this is very interesting developments because it means that the browser wars are alive and well. Competition. Because there's been this little consensus, kind of little meme that's been going around that's saying, oh, everyone's going to go to WebKit, and the web will just be WebKit. Microsoft should get rid of their stuff and just adopt WebKit. Mozilla should just get rid of their stuff and adopt WebKit. And then all the web will be running on the same engine. We can all optimize for it, and we'll all be happy. And now you have two organizations at roughly the same time saying, screw that. there's plenty of room for innovation, is basically what they're saying. And they're doing it in different ways. And so there will be more rendering engines. Huh?
Tridents?
I mean, Microsoft has been pushing. It's come a long way. It's getting there pretty competitive. And the main thing is there's a release cycle slower, but they're speeding that up too. So I'd say there's at least three horses in this race. And well, actually four, because Apple's not standing still either. So what this means, so one question naturally is, why? I mean, why can't everyone just say, screw it? I mean, if you look at other aspects of our computer infrastructure, people kind of a while ago said, okay, there's one implementation, there's two implementations, it's there, it works, it's done. But yet somehow, multiple groups are basically saying, we want to code next-generation web engines, we want to do it as fast as possible, and we want to have nothing slowing us down. We want to control the technology stack and make that the best. But we're implementing standards. Why are they so motivated? Why bother doing this?
Because it seems like web development is kind of disorganized, like a lot of things seems kind of hacky-ish. It's not like as organized as making like a desktop application, for example. Where
but heck, it's just a web application.
Yeah, but like in like a desktop application in Windows, right? Like you start up Visual Studio or whatever, and then you write your code and compile. It's like everything's like very structured, but like in web application, it's kind of like
But they're all still, but remember, these rendering engines are still just going to be implementing standard web standards. They may be pushing out new standards, they're not getting rid of the old standards, they're pushing the envelope of the web standards. So, I mean, what you're talking about sounds more like fixing the application frameworks, which is also happening. But what you're saying is true, but I don't think that's the real story here.
Conceptually replace the OS. It's like in the old days with Microsoft controlled Windows, and if you control Windows, you control everything that runs on it. And whoever ends up controlling the standard, or whatever you call it, the main browser, ends up in a sense controlling the new OS. And there's a lot of things.
Microsoft saw this in the 90s. The reason why they pushed Internet Explorer and started giving it away and wanted to get the, because I don't know if you knew this, but Netscape sold their browser. You could buy them in stores. You know, there was a price attached to it. Microsoft got rid of that. They gave away Internet Explorer for free because they knew that would become, that potentially had, could eclipse the desktop. That things could go on the web instead of going through the desktop. This would be the way you'd interact with your computer.
Did they really have that foresight, or was it a happy accident?
No, even in the 90s, when the web started coming out and everything started doing it, people saw the growth curve, people saw everything moving onto the web, and people saw, remember, in the beginning, there were at least Java applets, which were trying to provide things. The technology wasn't the best, but everyone saw the trend lines. And the idea is, who was going to control that? And that's what Microsoft tried to do with ActiveX, saying, okay, Windows technology will be at the center of the web experience. And that will be integrated with their browser, and only their browser, and they will control it. This is the same battle that's been going on, and this is the next generation of it. And the fact is, the technology now has gotten good enough to, people are saying, yeah, let's ditch the rest.
I mean, that's the reason why Samsung is coming up with Firefox, right? Samsung is the arch-rival of Apple for the next-gen devices.
And they're not exactly complete friends with Google either.
No. having some sort of a value out of it that goes beyond, it's a phone that's really light or whatever. Like, if you can claim speed and...
Right. Because, have any of you heard of PhoneGap?
Yep.
How many? So, you want to create a cross-platform mobile application. How do you do it? There are frameworks, one of which is PhoneGap, where you create an HTML5 application. So basically a web app inside your mobile application, and use a few extra little bits to access phone-specific stuff. And you have an app that looks pretty much like any other phone app. And it's mostly web technology. And in fact, most of the apps that you see on phones are mostly web technology. So you look at the separation between native apps and other things. The native apps, and if I make predictions, native apps are on. Not that native apps are going to go anywhere completely, but they're mostly on the way out because enough strong platforms are coming up, and the platforms are getting good enough at supporting the web, and the web is good enough for a cross-platform experience. Everyone's just going to run web apps. Because why not?
Because of latency.
No. So this is the question, is what does it look like when we say, when I say web technology, on a phone, it's installed locally. So what does that look like?
You can have local storage too.
So the newer APIs have local storage, but the web still kind of assumes that there's some sort of server, and there's some sort of, so if we're talking about a web app, what is a web app? It's a web server, web client code, and a back-end database, right? Those are the three things. Well, what are we getting now on these mobile platforms? Remember what I talked about with Apple having problems with core data and synchronizing databases and stuff? They're providing local APIs for databases on the phone. So there's your back-end store. Web server, you just got to give a little shim for saying where your links are and things inside your thing. You're going to have like a little trivial little web server in effect embedded in your framework. And then the rest of it's the client code. It's a web app on your phone, completely encompassed on your phone, with just a few little hacks to short circuit some things because you don't have to do that. So you don't have the high latency things going to the back end of the database. Well, really, the little stub web server is just a connection between the client code and the database. It's a translation layer.
So, for example, an Android phone, modern one, has Chrome on it. And I'm assuming that it runs JavaScript as well.
Yes.
Is the V8 embedded in Chrome accessible
That's what you're running. I mean, the V8 engine is the JavaScript interpreter.
Right, but what I'm wondering is it accessible by an application without running an instance of Chrome?
Oh, is V8 standalone? Not normally.
So
on something like Android, but you can make it standalone, and that's something called Node.
So does PhoneGap, what does it use for its code? Like HTML5, okay, I get it.
So it turns out on all these devices, when you run HTML5, you're running a web page.
Okay.
You have a DOM, you have everything. It's a little web page. And just all of the major phone, you know, platforms allow you to create applications out of sets of web pages, but they're all just served locally. This is one reason why I pushed very hard for this class to be core in computer science, it used to be the predecessor of this class was 2405. And 2405 did not cover, covered a little bit of JavaScript, was more focused on things like HTML, CSS, and was covered a lot of CGI bin things and stuff. And sometimes they call it covered PHP, and I was going like, you know, it was fine, but it was this optional course that people could take. Not everyone took it. It's like, now everyone needs to learn this. Everyone's got to learn these web technologies because that's the environment. That's what you code to. The code now is either to extend the web environment or to support the web environment. Why are they creating a new programming language? To build a web rendering engine. Are they even envisioning building any other code with Rust? No. They just want to build a web renderer. And they're saying, well, this will link into C++, you know, based on other libraries, but whatever necessary to make sure to reduce our attack surface, things, we'll re-implement those things in Rust. I mean, it's got to be a pretty darn important thing when you're willing to create an entire new programming language just to build that one application. I mean, people create programming language all the time, but I mean, this is a pretty serious language and a pretty serious application.
Kind of like when they made C to make Unix.
Yep.
Cool.
Create the language to suit the task at hand. And that's, I mean, this is the task at hand. So this is the center of the computer technology universe. Everything is converging upon this. And I don't see any significant things that point away from it.
Quantum computers. If they ever get them to
Well, quantum computers are, again, general purpose computing does not. No one says quantum computing will be general purpose computing. It just means your crypto keys will be trashed, and certain operations will be accelerated. It'll be like a GPU. It'll be the next generation GPU is what quantum computers will be. It'll be something you'll stick in your machine to execute very specialized tasks. And
it's pretty funny, there's a outfit out of DC actually that claims to have made a version of quantum computer. Lockheed Martin bought one for $10 million and put together a team of 100 engineers just to determine, is it actually a quantum computer?
Yeah, there's some interesting stories there. But the high level story here is saying that, yeah, it's the web. Everyone's investing in the web. Anytime people start saying, oh, I'm going to make my own platform, the story you should see there implicitly is a legacy application story. It's like, what? And this is the thing, Microsoft gets this and part of it doesn't. Because they, like, with the new Metro environment and things, they were saying, oh, they need some sort of interface. They need some sort of style and things like that. But then they realized, wait, we're going to make HTML and, you know, JavaScript and everything first-class citizens of this environment. Okay, great. First-class citizens, that sounds great. But then they've got all these other things. And this is why I think Microsoft is in really big trouble with respect to their next-generation APIs. It's like, what am I going to code for? Microsoft-specific APIs? Or web APIs that then I can use everywhere else. You know, if there's a market, like you're wanting to code a game for iOS, you're wanting to code a game for Android or something, you need performance, you're probably going to be using native stuff for now. But that's just for now.
WebGL and stuff's getting pretty good.
WebGL is getting good. I mean, the technologies are all just coming together, and you see this race in the web engine space is saying that, wow, there's a performance bottleneck here. Let's fix it. So what that means is the bottom is you have your OS and you have your web stack. And I'm saying these two, you might as well think of as one. Because that's what you're running on. But that does not mean that the story's over. That's just, instead of coding to C and the C library and things and that being the lowest level stuff, the lowest level will be JavaScript and HTML and CSS. And that's the foundation. What's on top? And that's actually where the really interesting stuff happens. Because now, this stuff, the big guys are busy pushing the platform ahead. This is what everyone's going to build their stuff on top of. But what are we going to build on this? What fits up here?
Notepad.
So
Minesweeper.
So remember last class, I talked about all the web application frameworks? And you saw that comparison of like, holy crap, look at that list. Everyone and their kid sister is creating a web application framework. What is this? That shows you where the really interesting stuff's happened. People realize, wow, the web technology stack, yeah, you keep adding new standards and you keep doing new things, but I don't want to code directly to that. I don't want to be directly implementing things in there. So in some sense, this class has been teaching you a bit of assembly. Next generation. Understanding JavaScript. I mean, this actually, language people have told me that JavaScript is the new assembly. It is not just in the ASMJS sense.
It's much better than assembly.
Yeah. It's much better than assembly. But still, it's a low level that you build on top of, that you don't necessarily code to. Like, you might want to code in CoffeeScript, which is a direct translation. Or you want to code in Java and have your entire app translated into JavaScript. Any of you learned processing? Have you all had processing? Okay. Processing.js. Look it up.
What?
Processing.js. JavaScript. Implementation of processing. Source code compatible. Exactly. You can take your processing code and deploy it on the web. As long as you didn't do too many weird Java things, but you just did regular processing things, you can run it in your browser without a plugin, just using JavaScript. Yes?
Outside of using the labor force that is skilled in Java and maybe not in other things, what would be the point of having Java compiled to JavaScript?
So the classic arguments against JavaScript is that it doesn't scale. And to a first approximation, that's wrong, of course, because very large programs are written in JavaScript. But in one sense, it is true in the sense that JavaScript doesn't protect you against a large class of errors. A lot of errors that can be caught at compile time in other languages can only be caught at runtime in JavaScript. And in that sense, it is a bit like assembly. And so if you want greater type safety, you want another language. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing. Some people, you want to build large applications that have lots of type interfaces and have it. That's fine. But it's not to say you can't do development that way, or you should, or whatever. It's just saying you can. That this is what's there. You want to implement stuff in your own favorite language. In a sense, we're coming into a bit of a golden age for the proliferation of computer language and development environments. Because everyone can now just target JavaScript and web technologies. And once you target that, if that's what your backend produces, you can run everywhere. I mean, it used to be you had to make a language that would kind of go down to this really low-level thing, and you had to learn the differences of every platform and stuff. You didn't learn it. You had to just target JavaScript in the web, and you can run everywhere. So now if I can create a better tool, and JavaScript is a rich enough thing that can support almost any programming paradigm. So you build you have your next generation language, it's fine. Just make sure it compiles to JavaScript.
Would you say then it's a waste of time to run the JavaScript framework?
I wouldn't say it's a waste of time.
There are tons of people who have lots of legacy applications.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. Waste of time to learn any framework is then you can say, oh, this is like that, this isn't like that.
Learning frameworks is not a waste of time per se, but understand what the structure of it is and what the where does it fit in the ecosystem. And what you're really seeing a lot of these things is that a lot of the early design is permit legacy stuff. And what you're going to see increasingly is these frameworks repurposed to target JavaScript and web technologies.
.NET compiles client-side to JavaScript.
Yeah. But see, it compiles client-side to JavaScript. Wait till it compiles server-side to JavaScript. Because you think, you want to run across platforms. I want to be able to run on an ARM processor. I want to be able to run on an x86 processor. Who knows what other processor I want? I'll just compile the JavaScript and then just have to make sure I have a good runtime for it. Done. I mean, think about how much, you know, innovation time. Like, Apple is now their own foundry. They're now designing their own microprocessors. They are following ARM licensees. I will bet you money that they are extending their chips in proprietary ways that only their tool chain will know about. And you know, most people won't care because they'll just compile the stuff down and you'll be running a layer above it. But if they can use that to get a bit of a performance boost, they will. Yep.
So, but not everything would, it doesn't make sense for everything to include that big fat layer of, does it? I mean.
So this is the question. Do you have a question?
No.
So, what would you not run on top of this? The only piece of this that makes sense not to run on top of this is the web server. That's all, the web server and the database. And you look today, what do you see?
My web server is a web app.
But you notice what's happening over here is even these are being taken over by web technologies. That's what Node is, an example of. The example of client technology getting so good, you might as well use it on the server. V8 was designed for the client and then got moved to the server. It's not to say that the server won't remain a distinct space because its performance characteristics are different from the client space, but the technologies will increasingly be shared. Because why not? If you develop a technology that's really good for the client, why not use it on the server? If it fits. Now, the one big piece of this that doesn't fit in this, that doesn't really fit in this quite, is the cloud. Right? And that's where really the web server and database stuff becomes different is when you talk about the cloud. And what, when I say the cloud this way, what am I talking about? So when people think of the cloud, they think of something, you know, more. But so, how many servers does Google have?
Millions.
Huh?
Thousands.
3,000.
2,000?
It's in the thousands. I'm not sure, but it's definitely more than 1,000.
Yeah. Anyone
else?
Server.
How many?
I don't know. Million.
Let's do a Google search.
It's about 2 million.
Yeah. There's one.
Google's right now current estimates I've seen are probably closer to 2 million. 2 million fully decked out PCs. I mean, when I say PC, I mean high end. I mean, they load them up with disk, they load them up with, you know, CPU, RAM, you know, they're, I mean, two million. Basically, when I say 2 million, I know it was a million about three or four years ago.
Someone on Google Plus has a prediction here, and he seems to have made it based on floor space using satellite images.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. But his estimate in January of 2012 was 1.79 million.
Do they take into account like rats or
so do you know how Google builds data centers now?
The shipping containers.
Containers. They take entire a container as in the back of a semi truck, and they make that into one unit. Full of, the racks are inside of it. So you build a data center, you park this in front of your, you have a little data center here. You want to make a bigger data center? You take 10 of them. They have self-contained power, self-contained cooling, self-contained everything. They're a unit.
They released a bunch of pictures.
How do they?
Facebook has also been doing this.
Yeah, just
they,
it.
Okay. It's not like an engine.
No, there's no engine. You basically give it power.
Okay, good.
You just give it power, and you give it air connection, and that's it.
Fiber.
Fiber ports, power.
No, that's by Wi-Fi.
That's interesting because server definition, I mean, there's the traditional sort of big iron, and then you can have, but the stuff they do now is the multi-blade, like the
these aren't blades.
Little atom.
They don't do blades. The big guys don't do blades. So the thing they can't, the really big guys, you look at the, you know, Google, Facebook, the high-end Microsoft stuff,
right.
What they look at is MIPS per watt.
Right.
So they are interested in getting the most performance out of per unit power because the most expensive thing in these large installations tends to be cooling. So to give you an idea of the power consumption here that you require for these kind of things is it used to be, where they're putting data centers now is where they used to put aluminum smelters. I don't know if you know about anything about the production of aluminum, but there's a reason why aluminum was like one of the first things that everyone wanted to recycle. It's because it's amazingly energy intensive to produce. You need lots of electricity. So normally what you do is you'd put it right beside a hydroelectric dam. That's where you stick your aluminum smelter because it has lots of power, it's very reliable, very clean, cheap. That's where you put a data center today. I mean, they consume amazing amounts of power. They consume, you know, space. I mean, this is the today's heavy industry is the cloud.
Wow.
And so when you're computing at this scale, things are different because the hardware is fundamentally unreliable. Hard drives, motherboards, CPUs and stuff fail out hourly. In the middle of computations, they die. All the time. No, it doesn't.
Sucks when it does for me.
Yes, but that's the difference with the cloud, is that it's so routine, memory errors are routine, that their entire software stack is designed to tolerate it. When Google loses a server, do they have someone go out and quickly fix it? No.
They have go-karts that they drive around.
All they do is they just say, some software mechanism says, hey, that server looks like it's died. Ignore it. How do you add new service to it? You plug it in, and the server auto-configures and does everything. There is no human involved in the standard maintenance of individual boxes because individual boxes are disposable.
Do they actually go in and take them out eventually?
They take out racks.
So
this rack is mostly dead, so we'll schedule it for our monthly maintenance, and then we'll take that rack out and put in a new rack, and then maybe we'll recycle it or, you know, refurbish it or whatever. But it's probably, by the time it's already there, they might as well just, they'll shred the hard drives, because of course it has confidential information. They'll shred the hard drive, recycle the material, and put a new rack in. They don't repair.
It's cheaper to...
Yeah. Yes.
I think it was Netflix that once a hard drive fails on one of their servers, they just get a new server.
No, Netflix does not, because Netflix doesn't control their hardware.
No.
Google does.
No, it's the boxes they have put in the actual data centers. They're just crammed full of hard drives, and they just let the hard drives die until, let's just replace this whole one.
Right. But I'm saying, up to recently, Netflix's infrastructure was with Amazon.
Yep.
And so, but I'm not sure, they may have some things of saying these certain racks or something theirs because they're such a big customer. But it's there is a virtual machine. So the virtual machine story is an interesting one, which I have not really talked about in this class. But basically, it's a way of running traditional operating systems on top of the cloud infrastructure. Now, I will tell you, virtual machines is legacy supporting technology. basically, because almost always what you're doing is you have a hypervisor, you have a classic operating system, and then you have a web stack. Why do I have to have a hypervisor in the, I mean, an operating system in the middle between my web stack and my hypervisor? Why can't I just run it directly in one layer? Why do I need the extra layer of software? And you don't. You go to a Google data center, they don't. They don't use virtual machines. They're just using standard Linux because they're running mostly their own stack on top of it. And that's way, that's what the cloud is moving towards. The virtual machines is a way of, one thing it does enable is sharing of resources. It means that I have 1,000 servers. Instead of giving one server to each, you know, to 1,000 people or some things, I can now subdivide them and share them. That's what virtual machines allow. But that's it. And when you get to a large enough scale, that's not worth it. That's overhead. You might as well just own the boxes. So if you're moving towards these systems with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of servers under the command of software, so if they all self-organize, and they, that's your web server. I mean, whoa. That's a software architecture. You should realize that. The client stuff, you should be able to understand. That stuff, you kind of go like, okay, I can see what is happening. The server stuff is an entire different ball of wax. When I say that things like Node can scale and other things like that, yes, as much as any particular technology. But when you look at all these guys, because how they scale their web apps, that's their bread and butter. How they do that is non-trivial computer science. Now, there is an evolving technology stack that's coming out there that's more turnkey. You all know the Hadoop project? So Hadoop is, what does it stand for? I think it's a third person. Does it stand for anything? Where did it come from? I don't know. But anyway, so Hadoop is a project that started off, they're a little bit different, but they're still mostly this, an open source re-implementation of technologies Google published in the open literature.
Which
Google has gone past and has now things, but this is a re-implementation of what they did. There are these things like the Google file system, Bigtable, MapReduce. Google was a real pioneer in making commercial-grade versions of this sort of technology to support their web services. And so, what's the key thing of these are all, MapReduce is a way of running, how do you sort the index? Or how do you make queries on an index consisting of billions of web pages spread across thousands of machines? How do you do that? MapReduce. How do you store all those files? GFS. How do I make a database that can scale across thousands of machines? Bigtable. Now, Bigtable does not support SQL. It's a no SQL thing because, again, okay, supporting full SQL semantics, full transactions and stuff was not something they could do across thousands of machines. The synchronization requirements were too high, so Bigtable doesn't have them. But again, if you're storing your email, how much concurrent access do you have? How many people are accessing your inbox at the same time? Hopefully just you, with maybe some email coming in.
You and your phone and your home computers.
Yeah, so there's a bit of concurrency, but not a huge amount. And how in sync do they have to be? Do they have to be synchronized to the millisecond? No. Just a few seconds off, maybe 10, 15 seconds, or even a minute off, whatever. So relaxing certain things so that you can scale is what they did. And now everyone else needs this technology. And so people are building this and extending it. And so, and that's when people talk about OpenStack, the cloud, and the OpenStack is an open source technology stack for building your own cloud. It's one of the things. So this has all these technologies for letting you take hundreds, thousands of machines and put them together into one system that will all do your bidding. But that's, so there's a whole lot to learn and a whole lot to do if you're thinking about how to engineer the back end. But The thing is, that's one class of things to engineer that. But if you architect your web application correctly, you can move on to those kind of infrastructures relatively straightforwardly. And that's what your goals should be when you're building a web app. It's not to say that you're not going to have some pain points. You're going to have some pain points when you try moving on to these large-scale systems. But if you architect it right, when you do things like realize the latency between your client and server is going to be relatively high, make your databases such that you don't depend on full transaction semantics unless you need to. Some things in how you do data design, we haven't really talked about that. But there are ways of doing it so that you have some chance of porting to these things. But porting to that is... That's tricky. And that's going to be a specialized thing, really making applications that run across it. And actually, one thing that remains to be seen is web application frameworks that will seamlessly transition to the cloud. That's one thing that still remains an open problem. Like, let's say I want to write an application today that would run at Facebook scale. Now I could design the interface and do everything, but how do I make it now scale so that millions of people can interact with it? Right now it's a whole lot of engineering. But in principle, that all could be abstracted in a certain way so that now it's just a layer. I just write the thing and someone else has done the engineering for me and I just deploy it on. That's coming. That's definitely coming. But then, what about the data? Where's the data going to live? Right now, there's a move towards the big providers having all the data. But really, if I want to run Facebook as an application, how much of it actually needs to reside in the cloud? How much of that data? If I want my friends and stuff to be able to access my pictures and other things and stuff, yeah, it needs to be online. But couldn't it be just my own server? How much concurrent access is there really to my photos?
Lots, because Facebook sells it to advertisers, and you're, as we speak, probably advertising some sort of a beer and something else across the globe.
So you see, but...
Copyright laws aren't the same as the U.S. laws, so they don't have proprietorship to Canadian photographs.
Score!
The Privacy Commissioner, I know some people in the Privacy Commission, they're good people.
but the point being is that from a personal user, like the individual, yeah, sure, how many people do you actually want access to?
But what I'm saying is this business reality is that everyone wants some data to be accessed by different people and some data to be shared. And right now, the only way to facilitate easy sharing is essentially a mainframe model. We dump it all there, and then they let everyone give access. I don't know how much is going to happen, but my intuition and all the technological things that we're going to move away from that. There's going to be the big Googles, there's going to be good Facebook, but there's going to be something where those little apps you download on your phone, it won't just be a local thing. You'll be able to do that in the cloud. Be able to have the apps to control your data and be able to give views of it and being able to say, okay, now I'm going to share my photos here, and my photos may not be on my physically controlled machine, but will be in a virtual storage that I control, that I can move, and I can control what programs have access to.
That whole Lightstream model?
Potentially.
What about, P2P stuff? There was a software I saw the other day where they basically just show you an image, but that image gets loaded from another client of their server, if possible. So basically loads it from any user's
Well, that is really the model. It's like things people talk about, things like Diaspora and stuff. That really is implementing Facebook in a peer-to-peer architecture. So, in web terms, what is a peer-to-peer technology? What does it look like?
BitTorrent?
It's just... No, but I'm saying in web technology, it's just web servers that make requests to other web servers. That's all it is. It's web servers that can act as web clients. Or you're talking about web clients that access multiple web servers concurrently and combine the data locally. That's all that peer-to-peer looks like in a web context. It's just web servers talking to each other and distributing stuff. Now, I mean, not to say there aren't more sophisticated peer-to-peer protocols and there's other things too, but that's... But there's so much... But even if you look at all the peer-to-peer protocols, oftentimes they're running over HTTP anyway. Because that's the protocol that goes across the internet. So that's going to be, again, the web server, the web client, becomes the basis of the technology stack. But I think decentralization, all this stuff with the web application frameworks, I think as we get that technology more and more set, we're going to see more settling down to certain ways of doing things that will enable another level of where the there won't be this gap between, oh, here's my little website, and I'm doing my stuff, versus here's what Google and Facebook do. Because what it used to be is like, okay, I was a little guy, and I had a little bit of software, and I thought it was really cool, and I want to sell it to everyone. You start selling it, and the more copies you sell, the more money you make, and the better you do. Now, if you start selling a web service, and you start making money and stuff, very quickly, you're screwed. Because now too many people are accessing your server.
Yeah, but then you just put it on Amazon.
Well, you put it on Amazon. That means now you have access to computational infrastructure, but you still have to engineer it to run across multiple systems. It's not a turnkey thing. You can't just say, oh, I've done this now. Now I'll run across 20 servers. Now I'll run across 200. Now I'll run across 2,000. You have to build your software so it will work that way. We don't have the infrastructure of doing that automatically. We're going to build it. That will be there. And then you'll start seeing a much greater difference where the next generations will be able to do that. But of course, the real barrier then saying is, who pays for those servers? But what if the servers are paid for by the customers? It's just my server. I want to do a photo sharing app. I decide to opt into using this guy's photo sharing thing. Now my server is running their photo sharing stuff. It's now providing the computational resources for running it. 10,000 people do that, now all of a sudden you have a 10,000 machine web farm that can distribute the load across it. You know, that really changes the economics of things of organizations like Google and Facebook and stuff where they make their money after being all centralized and running ads and stuff. When that's going to happen, that's going to happen to some degree. How much is going to happen? How much is going to compete? I mean, certain things like web indices, it's not sure how much you can... How much that can be distributed across? How much does that need to be centralized? But that's an open question. I mean, why can't search be something that everyone contributes cycles to and the index is completely distributed across the internet as opposed to having a central organization control it? If someone can pull that off, you know? The trick is, if you do this right, it just will emerge from the bottom. It will grow organically up. They won't be able to stop it. So what does that lead to for software distribution? Eggs?
Headaches.
How do you make money in this world?
Gotta have money to make money.
How do you make a small fortune? Start with the big fortune.
Find a niche, execute well.
But the software as a service is more than just a buzzword. All the trends are towards software being something that is spread around. People are now trying to make money off of controlling the servers. That's what Google and Facebook are doing. They control the servers where the software runs, and so they're trying to monetize that. They lose the capacity to monetize that because it becomes some sort of distributed infrastructure. Now everyone's paying for it. That money source goes away. Then how do you make money? You make money by providing services. By someone says, I have this technical problem that needs to be solved. Pay me and I will help you solve it. And that's where most software developers are employed now. Most software developers are employed in organizations that are not software companies. They're employed in businesses of various types, nonprofits, whatever, governments, for doing things internally. That's not going to change. That's going to be even bigger. Now, what will things like Microsoft and the big software companies become? They become providers of solutions. They say, you have a problem to solve. We will solve your problem at a larger scale. We'll make it so that rather than you hiring a bunch of developers to do this and waiting a couple of years to do this, we'll provide you the solution today for your problem. That's what, you know, businesses like Oracle really are in the business of. That's what IBM is very much in the business of. That business is not going away. Now, not to say that, you know, you want to make your money off games that you sell on the iPhone, you know, in the App Store or something. That market will still be there. I don't think little, you know, small-scale commercial development for entertainment purposes particularly are going to go away. But it's a different world.
But, you know, that's the thing to innovation, though, is ultimately every single one of these software companies came up with an innovative solution of some sort. It may have evolved into a service or a platform, but it existed to begin with to address some sort of a business problem.
Right, no, but
and so you can still come up with new...
See, originally, software was a service.
Right.
You bought software with the hardware, and then you hired programmers. You paid IBM for your mainframe. When you got your mainframe, you got some software with it. You paid some licensing fees, everything, for maintaining the software and hardware. You maybe paid programmers to take care of it. Then there was personal computers. Then there was shrink wrap software. You went out and bought it. Then came the cloud providers, where they provide servers, and you become the product, not the customer. They sell your eyeballs. And that model is not going. But now, the old models never go away. You just get new models. So it's not to say that this advertising model is going to go away completely, by no means. But now, what's the next model? The next model is really going back to the old model, which is the services, except decoupled from the hardware. Which is really what a lot of open source stuff is supported on. But not...
In a sense, like, the cloud is the new modified mainframe.
Yes, exactly. The cloud is the modified mainframe. You pay by the hour. Which is what you do is do on the mainframe. It's just a heck of a lot cheaper. It's utility computing is just about here. The difference is that utility computing is over there, and in your desktop or your phone or whatever is ridiculous numbers of cycles. So it's this computer and that computer. And that's what the web is about. It's this computer talking to that computer. Those computers. Lots of those computers. And when you're doing development, you're really doing about development over there to service this. Either it'll be installed here and be resident, or it'll be loaded at runtime. That's the only difference between an app and a web page, is when you want to access it, is the data already there, or do you have to download it on demand? It's the only difference. So the last thing I'll put in here is, what about security? Security's easy. So we know what a security compromise looks like on your own computer. What does it look like? It looks like your computer's taken over its own, you have to do a reinstall. What does it look like in the cloud?
Data theft.
So right now, what we mostly see in the cloud is data theft. Confidential information. Someone getting in, infecting a system, and taking the information out. But what does it look like?
Resource theft.
No. What does it look like? A crash. What's the equivalent of a virus trying to reformat your hard drive?
Well,
I mean, what if a piece of malware tried to reformat Google?
Nice.
Or Facebook? These are services that are never rebooted in a sense. They're full of disposable components, but the whole service stays running all the time. Parts of it go away, but the whole is basically still running, and you just incrementally... What happens if you wipe it all at once?
Or you hit their power plant with a...
They don't have one power plant. They're geographically distributed. There's no one power plant. The way you compromise this is with software, not a physical attack. No, but this is the, this is something that none of the cloud providers want to talk to you about. Because all the technological things are making it so that the endpoint devices are actually remarkably secure. They're getting more and more hardened. They're not perfectly hardened. There's still potentially ways to infect them, but they're getting much more robust. But the server side isn't. And that's where all the stuff is. That's where all the stuff you care about is in the server. It's running the same stack. It's running the same languages. It's not, we haven't all of a sudden gotten a whole bunch smarter. It's still all the same security problems you worried about before. It's like, now, maybe they're professionally managed, maybe they're a little bit things, but it's still the same stuff. It still has a potential for
no one's downloading toolbars onto them.
Yes, that
yes,
does help.
But
I tell you, within the next many years, what are you doing on your Facebook thing? What apps are you incorporating into your account? People incorporate all kinds of random stuff into their account.
But that gets into the full stack of security, because talking about security as some crazy virus that eats GFS, I mean, it's cool, but the reality is that that's not going to happen instantaneously. We're not talking about millions of hosts, and we're talking about latency of actual communication. And if something horrible like that,
it might take an hour.
Yeah, but I mean, there's people monitoring this stuff, and they call, they disable the...
So do you all know about SQL Slammer?
No. Yes.
The Slammer virus infected every machine it could on the internet, everything that was acceptable, in 15 minutes. And people have devised flash viruses that could potentially do things like that in less than a minute. This stuff was all more research in the early 2000s, and people were thinking about it. And people haven't really talked about these kind of flash things anymore, because nowadays mostly the attackers care to infecting more quietly, because they're more interested in commercial advantage.
Right.
But the risks don't go away. So all I'm saying is that we have now created a whole other level of centralization. Your application may be running across thousands of machines, but it's running a single coordinated software architecture. You compromise one part of it, you can potentially own the entire thing. And that's accessible by everyone in the world. So this should make you think that I don't care how good they are. Are you saying, have you ever seen a game of, if you look at the security space, have you ever seen a game where, given attackers and defenders and sufficiently motivated attackers, the defenders can completely stop them?
No.
In this game, sufficiently motivated attackers always win.
Be a sufficiently motivated attacker.
No. And do you think no one's motivated to take out Google?
You're getting into mad territory, though, like mutual assured destruction. Basically, anybody who decided to take out Google would probably set off some pretty major movements, and I would imagine the source would be tracked down pretty fast. Like, the chance of a kid coming up with this little...
This is not a kid-level problem.
No, right. So this would be a state-level attack. And if you're going there, then, I mean, that's just important.
They're
doing
it right now,
anyways.
Yeah.
Well,
I
know,
right.
I guess what I'm saying is espionage is happening
more likely. Espionage is happening right now. But
outright destruction is not profitable.
What I'm saying with this is that in the world of personal computers,
right,
that were disconnected from each other, if I wanted to take them all out, it would be very, very hard.
Yeah,
it would centralize. I would have to go around and start doing things that would spread over the course of months, and a lot of machines would never be infected because people think that they'd be perfectly fine. We are in a centralized world now. It's not just that there's the internet enabling the communication, it's that there are these centralized services. Like, the internet is not susceptible to this in that way. It's very diverse. The infrastructure's got lots of different things, but these key pieces of internet infrastructure are not.
How about the 8 North American smart grids?
Yeah, there's power grids and such nothing. But like this central, we have centralized things in our computational infrastructure, and this is dangerous. There's a whole other level of danger from the existing kinds of dangers, and it's one that really worries me. So the web is here. The web is taking over everything, and the web is really vulnerable. Not from because your client device is vulnerable, but because the servers are.
So the takeaway from this is that feasibly someone could attempt to do something like they do in Live Free or Die Hard.
I don't know what I don't know the plot.
They do a fire sale where basically they get a bunch of it's ridiculously over the top. Basically, the premise is they steal control over all of the U.S.'s. The communications, power, everything.
And, traffic lights.
All through internet. And,
Outsourcing coders.
It's getting there. Well, the trouble is right now, all that infrastructure is rather diverse. And attacking any one of them is a massive enterprise. The problem is if it's just one infrastructure. Like, if it's all hooked into the Google infrastructure.
It's actually simpler than you think because the amount of SCADA providers is actually quite small. There's about 5 of them that are major ones. So
I know. But yeah, the SCADA problem is certainly there, but I'm more concerned with the control systems of the SCADA systems. But
and again, control systems, if they're all talking.
But so really, what I want you all to go out there is not so much be scared, but please put Google and Facebook out of business. No, I mean quite seriously. This is I think very feasible. In terms of building a technology stack that would enable small developers to scale up to cloud size. That's, I think, a really interesting problem and a really interesting space to go in. It's like, make that middleware that allows you to just go out there and, now I want to deploy on 10,000 machines versus one machine. You don't have to build it, but keep an eye out for it. Because when it comes around, use it. Because it'll give you an advantage. It lets you compete with the big boys. And I think that is what's going to really protect us long term, is that we'll just get rid of the big guys because we won't need them anymore. They'll be split up. Not through a government kind of thing, but just because the technology will move fast enough around them. That's the optimistic scenario. Or they'll come crashing down, burning, and then we'll have to rebuild. So we'll see. Last questions. On that happy note. And on Tuesday, we'll talk. I'll tell you about the final exam, give you lots of questions. If you want to do sample questions, you can to improve your grade. But I think most of you have pretty perfect grades on the earlier part, so it would help. And then.
I have a question.